This is Audible.
Simon and Schuster Audio presents Jewel by Brett Lott. Read by Celia Weston.
I was born in 1904, so that when I was pregnant in 1943, I was near enough to be past the rightful age to bear children. This would be my sixth, and on that morning in February, the first morning I'd known I was with child, I'd simply turned to Leston in bed next to me, the room gray from a winter sky outside the one window, and that sky not yet lit with the sun, and I'd said, "There will be no more after this one." He rolled onto his back, his eyes still shut, the little hair he still had wild and loose on his head. He put his hands behind his head and gave a sort of smile, one I'd seen enough times before this, 5 times before to be exact. He said, "Another one. What makes you think so?" "Doesn't take divining, not after 5. I just know." Then came the morning sounds, sounds of the everyday of our lives. First, the slam shut of the front door as James, our oldest, started on his way to work at Crampton's Lumber. Then the scrape of our other 2 boys, Burton and Wilman, from their room above us. The first sounds of tussling and fooling that started now and ended only after dark, the boys back in bed. "Those two," I thought as I lay there. We'd had 'em too close together. Burton 7, Wilman almost 6. Billie Jean, my second child, would not be up for as long as I would let her sleep. Around her on the bunched and rumpled blankets of her bed, the movie magazine she lived for, fanned around her like leaves off a tree. And Anne, my baby, would be stirring soon, then following Burton and Wilman around like a lost dog, wanting only to be one of them, blessed by the rough and tumble of pinecone wars and whittling knives. Leston sat up in bed, turned so that his back was to me, his feet on the floor. He looked to the window, and then down to the floor. He brought a hand to his face, rubbed it, ran that hand back through his hair. Wisps of it still hung in the cold air, copper going gray. The line of his shoulders still the same hard and broad line I'd seen the first time I met him, the same shoulders I'd held while we'd conceived each of our children this far. But now his head hung forward, his hands holding tight the edge of the mattress. I thought I could see for the first time the weight of age upon him, those shoulders with the burden of our years and our 5 children. One of 'em already set to working his way through the world, and me with a brand new one now on the way. Leston lifted his face to the gray window again, gave out a heavy breath that shone in a small cloud before him, the room so cold. "No more after this'll set fine with me." Then I shivered, felt it through my whole body. Shiver so deep, whatever warmth I'd had between the quilts disappeared entirely. I let out a deep breath, too, saw the cloud it made in the room, and in that breath I saw what I'd known all along, known all the days till this one, when I'd been thinking maybe, just maybe I was going to have another child. It was me, too, that age was weighing down on hard. I sat up in bed, put my feet on the cold pine floor, and stood. I was on my way to the door and breakfast when Leston, behind me and still on the bed, spoke up. "Jewel Hilburn, you take care." I turned to him, my hand already on the doorknob. He'd gotten that smile back, his eyes the same deep water green I'd known for what felt all my life. I held my eyes on him. "You know I will." He nodded. "That I do." Then I was out the door and on into the kitchen. I'd taken care of myself most all my days, though things had eased up once I met Leston. Before that, though, before Leston and the stop and start of our having children and trying to feed our own selves, there was a world sometimes I would like to sooner forget than think about at all. But it's history that matters, what keeps you together in the tight ball of nerves and flesh you are, and makes you you and not someone else. I was an orphan at age 11, my mother dead of a fever, my father not 2 months before she passed on, having broke his neck on a log just under the water at the bend in the Black River, the bend nearest town where the post oak lay low to the water and where in spring light through the leaves breaks across the river so that nothing can be seen beneath. He broke his neck right then, right there, with the quick and simple dare of diving into water. And when I was a little girl of 11, with both my mother and father gone, and me living suddenly with a grandmother I'd only met 3 times before, I used to imagine it wasn't a fever that killed my mother, but a broken heart at the death of her beloved. But the truth was, he'd moved into a logging shack a year before he broke his neck, and only showed up to our house at twilight on Saturday nights to have at my mother, then to attend church the next morning, his black hair slicked back and shiny with pomade. It was the thick and sweet smell of his hair that woke me up Sunday mornings, me staying up just as late as the two of them the night before, listening through the walls to the mystery they tended to each Saturday night. Sounds I'd hear again only when Leston and I were together, so that on our wedding night, 12 years later, the low moan he made and the pitch and twirl of sounds I heard coming from me were like the ghosts of my long-dead parents, sounds I knew but had forgotten in the cloud of years, filled with taking care of me and me alone. The day he broke his neck was a Tuesday. I was already home from school and out on the porch with my tablet and thick red pencil, doing my figuring for the next day. I knew even then I wanted to be a teacher, something in me with the need to lead and stand before people and explain in a plain and simple voice bits of the world they could not know were it not for me. On that Tuesday, I saw the shapes of 4 men through the green of the forest. Then they cleared the trees, and I could see them, hair wet, faces white, jaws set with the weight of whatever lay in the doubled-up gray wool blanket they toted. One man to a corner, the middle sagging, nearly touching ground with each step they took. They wore only undershirts and blue jeans, all of them barefooted, their feet red with the dust of the road they'd walked. The 4 of them moved toward the house, struggling with the burden they bore, the wool blanket seeming heavier than anything I'd seen before. Yet they were gentle with it, edged it up and onto the porch itself an inch toward us, me and Mama, finally letting it down onto the wood with a grace I would never see again. They stood back from it, 4 men with hands on the hips, eyes on the heap before us. Then one of them squatted, his elbows on his knees, eyes still on the blanket. He had hair as black as my daddy's, hair flat and wet with strands of it long down and into his eyes. He put out a hand and held it a moment above the wall, then reached down, took hold of the blanket, pulled it back to reveal to us my dead and naked father. He spoke without looking at us.
We were swimming, and then he just didn't come up. He was jumping off.
I heard my mother behind me. Benjamin, stop. The man, this Benjamin, looked up, his finger stopped moving his eyes on my mama. She had a hand to her eyes, the other at her throat, and then I moved toward the blanket. I wanted to see the face, and as I made my way toward where I would see him, 2 of the men who'd carried him here moved out of my way, the hands still on the hips. I stood next to this Benjamin and looked down at my daddy's face. His lips had gone blue, his eyelids gray, his hair matted and snarled. Benjamin let go the blanket. Your daddy and me was brothers. But the words didn't mean anything to me. I was thinking of Sunday mornings and the smell of pomade and of me sitting between the two of them while Pastor gave up to God our congregation's prayers and how my God had finally answered the prayer I'd been whispering to myself while Pastor pleaded for everyone else. I wanted him never to come back. Here was my reward for righteous, heartfelt prayer, for asking in Jesus' name what I knew would make my mama and me better off in the long run, no matter what those sounds I heard from their room meant. Which is why I reached down and picked up the edge of the blanket my uncle had let fall and pulled it back over my daddy, covered him up. The four men were watching me now, waiting, I figured, for whatever might happen next. I said, "Bring him on inside. Somebody go find Pastor, too." I have taken care of myself since the moment I pulled the blanket over him, a fact Lester already knew before he'd even let out his words to the cold morning of our room. I knew what loss was, knew what it was God could take away from you. His answers to prayer, sometimes the greatest curse you could call down. But even so, I prayed right then and there, my husband sitting on the edge of our bed and growing old in what seemed only the few moments we'd been awake, myself going the same way too, I knew, that the baby inside me would be born alive and breathing with 10 fingers and 10 toes. That was all I sought, what I figured couldn't be too much to ask. We'd buried my daddy the next day, him lying out in the room off our kitchen just overnight. Time enough for Pastor to have his hand at trying to comfort us and time enough for my mama to dress Daddy in a bundle of fine clothes I'd never known we had. Time enough, too, for the men who'd brought him to get back to the logging camp and settle up his monies with the foreman, then pack up his belongings, all of them fitting into one yellowed pillowcase. When the four of them showed up on our porch the next morning, they were all cleaned up and wearing what I figured were their best clothes. New jeans and white shirts buttoned up to the throat, boots rubbed with a daub of oil. I'd been the one to answer the door, and Benjamin let him in, the pillowcase slung over his shoulder. Once they'd filed in, Benjamin let it fall off his back and held it in front of him and then gently set it on the floor. He nodded to my mother. "Ma'am." He knelt, the pillowcase on the floor, blossoming with the move so that what lay inside suddenly spilled out. "This here's his things." I leaned forward and looked down at the small pile. No one else moved, not even Mama, and for a moment I felt I'd somehow betrayed her by giving in to what lay here. But then I knelt too and began to take things up and examine them for what they might tell me about the man I'd wished dead. The first thing I picked up was a cigar box. I shook it. The sound like rocks inside. I opened it and found only one rock, a chunk of fool's gold the size of my first 3 fingers. Next were 2 cufflinks, cheap things. In there, 2 were 3 small arrowheads, nothing special. There was nothing else in the box. No one spoke while I pawed through my daddy's souvenirs. What he deemed keepable from his life, this pile, his legacy to me and my mama. There were a few picture postcards from New Orleans, a steamboat, Jackson Square, another of a smiling black mammy, a little burr head next to her. Scrolled across the bottom of the picture were the words, "Greetings from New Orleans." On the backs of the cards were no words and no stamps, only blank space and the small words telling who'd printed up the cards. I held them in my hand, just looking at the empty space. Benjamin said, "He couldn't write nor read, of course, neither." I said, "When was he there in New Orleans?" Mama was the one to speak. "That's where your daddy and I had our honeymoon, right down in the French Quarter. That's where he got those." "Oh," I said. Then I found the tin of pomade there beneath a shirt with 3 buttons missing. I opened up the can and saw inside the dull pink swirls, evidence of his fingertips. I snapped back on the lid as quick as I could. I reached down to the bottom of the sack where a photograph lay face down, all I could see of it, the curly-cued edges of the paper. The white back faded to brown. I picked it up, turned it over. It was a picture of a man. The photograph soft and worn as though it had been crumpled and rolled flat any number of times. He stood next to a big wingback chair, his elbow resting on top and the other hand on his hip. His chin was hard, the bones in his cheeks high, his skin even darker than my daddy's. His eyes were black, turned from the camera to something far off. He had on a white hat, the crease in the crown perfect, and the vest he wore black and white stripes, gray pants. Even through the wrinkles and folds of the photograph, I could feel the attitude he bore, the one that kept the eyes focused somewhere else and the hand at the hip, his head tipped just a hair to the left, as if daring the photographer to hold it up straight. "Who is this?" Benjamin said. "That's his daddy, our daddy, your grandpa." He paused. "Jacob Chautauqua. Then Jacob Chandler, Choctaw, was. He been dead 21 years. I looked up to Mama. Her eyes were closed now. I turned to the photograph and tried to figure out what this might mean. My grandpa an Indian. But it only took a moment before I felt my fingers go hot and felt my face flush at the sudden knowledge that things tumbled down from this photograph. Down to me and who I was and the part of me that gave me the same black fine hair my daddy had, the same thin nose, the same skin that stayed more tan than any child I knew, even through the dead winter, while my mama's skin turned red after 20 minutes outside. I held it with both hands and ran a finger across the soft paper, and I saw for the first time that no matter how much I'd wished my daddy gone, he would always be with me. Here in me, just as he was here in his own daddy. This was me I saw in the photograph. I stood. I could feel everybody's eyes on me now, even Mama's. "This is what I'll keep." And I turned, headed to the kitchen. Once in there, I didn't know what to do, where else I could go. Then I saw a cathedral in the doorway. She was holding a huge blue cook pot, her thin arms straining with the weight, the muscles there shiny with sweat. I moved to the screen door, the photograph in one hand, and pushed it open. She moved in, and already I could smell the food. Chicken, I knew, and sweet potatoes and collards and biscuits. She made it to the stove and set the pot down. She opened her eyes and looked at me only a moment, her eyes never meeting mine, before she brought them to the floor. She'd never looked at me any longer than that. All I knew of her was that a nigger girl had showed up at our house not a week after my daddy'd left and had been here 3 times a week since to weed out in the garden or clean out the coop, take eggs into town, chop off the heads and pluck the chickens we would eat, while my mama sat on the porch and I practiced my multiplications. One evening, a few weeks after she'd started, I asked Mama where she'd come from, how she'd gotten her name. Mama'd answered that Cathedral's family'd been owned by Catholics in Bogalusa, and that she'd hired her on, now Daddy was gone, that she'd been paying her a nickel a week. I believed her about the name, but I knew that the money paid out wasn't true. I'd never even seen the two of them talk to each other, much less exchange any money between them. Cathedral gave her arms one last shake and stopped. The room was choked with the smells of food now, and I realized I hadn't eaten since the day before. Then Cathedral spoke, and for an instant I didn't know where the voice came from or whose it was, my mind on chicken and collards and sitting down to eat. "Missy Cook, she say bring this here to you." I hadn't seen her mouth move, her eyes still on the floor. She put her hands together in front of her. "I'm sorry about your papa." I heard myself say, "Thank you." She looked up at me again. "Missy Cook, she say tell you one more thing. She say tell you she the one be paying me to work for y'all. and she say she want you to come live with her now your papa gone. She paused and looked back to the floor. I mean now your papa pass on. Missy Cook, my mother's mother, a woman of standing, of bearing. She lived in Purvis proper, on Willow Street, in a big house with windows and drapes and fine china plates we actually ate off of, my mom and me. The last time we were there was just before Daddy'd left. The other two times I'd been too small to recognize an occasion. But I'd seen the furniture and had been told to stay off it by the woman who now wanted me to come live with her. Cathedral glanced toward the door in the front room where my mom and Benjamin and three other men were, none of them making a sound. And be one more thing, she say she gonna raise you up right. She not be making the same mistake she make with your mama. She say you her last chance in this world.
She told you to tell me that?
She shrugged. Yes'm, except the last part. Part about raising you up right and about the mistakes and all. I thought of my mama marrying some half-breed Choctaw who couldn't read or write, and me being born to the two of them, so that in Missy Cook's eyes, I was the biggest mistake her daughter could ever make. And now I was her personal mission, what she wanted to save from the horrors of low living in this world. I looked at the photograph in my hand and wondered at the man there, my grandpa, and what it took to hold your head just that way. Who you had to be. I looked at Cathedral.
Why did you tell me?
She shrugged again. Don't need no reason, just figured to warn you. Then I wasn't hungry anymore, and I turned and went into the front room and passed them all, nothing any different than when I'd left, my daddy's belongings still spread on the floor. I went to my room, got from under my bed one of my tablets, a pencil. I took one more look at the photograph, then slipped it between pages in the back of the tablet. When I came back into the kitchen, Cathedral had already pulled out the food from the pot. Heaps of chicken and cornbread, bowls of collards and gravy, a sweet potato pie, all of it in serving dishes from the same fine china we'd eaten from in a three-story house in downtown Purvis. She heard me come in, turned from the food.
Cathedral, you know how to write.
She gave her head a quick shake, put her hands behind her. I moved to the screen door, pushed it open.
Come with me.
She glanced up again and then looked to the doorway into the front room as though we were betraying those in there by abandoning this food and who it came from, the woman Cathedral worked for, the woman who wanted my life. She stood still a moment and then said,
Yes'm,
and moved toward me. I taught her to write, and she taught the man she ended up marrying, then taught her own children as well, so that the four niggers outside our back door, all of them employed by my Leston, could read and write. And as I stood at the stove and carved off pieces of bone bacon into the skillet, I held some small piece of pride in me, thought that maybe I'd been a good teacher after all. The four of them, Nelson, her husband, and their three boys, Sepulcher, Temple, and Kresh, worked for Leston cutting down pines, then blasting up the stumps and hauling them down to Pascagoula, where they'd be turned to turpentine for the war effort. It was my part to feed them all. Each morning I woke to fry up eggs and bacon, boil grits and bake biscuits for my family, Cathedral's boys, and the rest of Leston's crew, Garland and J.E., cousins of Leston's, and Toxie, Leston's nephew, the three of them, the supervisors over the crew. Then six more niggers, boys and old men from up and down the woods. We had four trucks in all, plus the Caterpillar, none of it in any way as near good shape. Toxie and Sepulcher working on one another of them from time to time. They put the breakfast plates down until they disappeared up the road and headed home. But we had vehicles, Leston would say, time and again. Ones that gave us this roof over our heads, let our children wear clothes, and gave us food to eat. Food, I'd decided 3 years ago when he started in with but one lonesome truck and Nelson only, would be part of their pay. We were comfortable in this house, the one Liston had built for us, and we had the steady work this world war provided, a twisted sort of blessing, I knew. We could give them food. Burton banged into the room. Behind him, Willman, the two of them in their bib overalls and still fighting. But rather than holler at them to quiet down this first morning new life was in me, I took a second to look at them, at how they'd grown. Willman with the sprinkle of Leston's freckles across his nose. Burton's skin taking my complexion, the tan and my black hair. Willman's front teeth were out, and when he gave a sneer to whatever it was they were arguing over, I could see all the way into his mouth, the child red gums, the perfect white teeth. Then he shoved Burton's shoulder, knocked him into the table. One of the chairs fell over. Burton turned to me. "Mommy, you saw that, Mama?" "Yes, I did." I sliced the last two pieces of bacon into the skillet, the fragrant steam off the meat already making its way up and into our morning. I wiped my hands on the towel hung on the oven door, then put both hands on my hips. "Willman, pick up the chair before your daddy gets in here and straighten up the two of you."
"Yes, ma'am."
Willman looked at Burton, in his eyes the hate brothers can only have for each other. Burton, of course, stood with his arms crossed, his head tilted just the same way his great-grandpa's had in the photograph framed and hung in the front room of this house. It wasn't the first time I saw Burton in that pose, a stance I knew he'd picked up studying that picture, and each time he struck it I wondered if there weren't some danger to it, some invitation buried deep to lead the wrong-headed life Jacob Chandler had led. My mama had been the one who'd finally told me what I wanted to know about him and told me, too, what I shouldn't have heard. On the last day she was alive, my mama, about to die in the luxury of a house in downtown Purvis, the two of us dressed up like china dolls in a store window. She told me of the man in the photograph, though I hadn't asked her straight about him. Instead, I'd been spending days beside her bed trying best to avoid Missy Cook and the book she'd already laid out for me to read, Middlemarch and Pride and Prejudice and Wuthering Heights. All of them books I just as soon would read on my own, but Missy Cook's view of me and the world was angled so that the only thing I could do with her was be what she wanted me to be, read what she wanted me to read, answer the questions she wanted answered. Missy Cook. That's all any of us were ever allowed to call her. Missy Cook was a tall woman, her hair coiled up in a huge gray bun that sat atop her head. She wore eyeglasses with silver rims, and behind the glass, brown eyes like bits of broken glass sunk deep into her sockets. Many's the night I've had dreams of those eyes, and how, after my mama was dead, she bore into me with them like a red-hot poker, an old woman aware of her powers. That first evening we'd arrived a little after sunset and climbed down off Pastor's wagon. Behind us only Mama's rocking chair, our clothes wrapped in bed sheets. A frail nigger woman met us at the door, her hips not much wider than cathedrals, and I knew right off this was her mama. Once inside and the door closed behind us, Mama turned to the nigger woman. "Molly, how are you?" Molly tried to smile, gave a small curtsy.
"I fine, Miss Patricia. It'd be nice having you back to home here, the two of you."
"This is true." The voice came from behind us, and we all three turned to it. Then Molly was gone. Missy Cook was coming down the stairs, one hand on the polished banister, the other at her chest. The frown I'd always seen her with was still there, chin held high, her deep and frightening eyes shrouded even more so by the thin light from the gas-lit chandelier above us. My mama's chin was high, too, and I saw the muscles in her jaw begin to work, her teeth clenched. She put out a hand first, and I followed. Missy Cook hadn't yet looked at Mama, but at me. her hand warm in mine, softer than I had imagined it would be. She looked into my eyes.
I am deeply saddened at your daddy's passing.
I let myself believe her for an instant. Then I heard Mama, "No, you're not." She moved past Missy Cook and to the staircase. She put a hand on the banister, placed one foot on the first step, and stopped. "Jewel?" I was still holding Missy Cook's hand, felt her fingers going tight around mine. Her eyes had never left my face. I looked at the polished wood floor, the gleam of the chandelier there. "Yes, ma'am." Missy Cook let go my hand. I walked around and toward Mama, who held out her own hand to me, and the two of us started up the stairs. Later, after we'd gone through the boxes of new dresses stacked in the room we were to sleep in, all of them made of lace and fine linen and pearl buttons, and after we'd eaten the pork chops and cheese grits and okra and biscuits Molly'd brought up to us on that same fine china, Mom and I climbed into bed together, the two of us wearing matching white nightgowns with thin, pink ribbons at the wrists and neck. Then Mama climbed back out, went to the gas key at the door jamb. But as she reached for it, Missy Cook opened the door, held her hand over the key. Mom and I both jumped, me taking in a breath, Mama bringing a hand to her face as though Missy Cook might hit her. "No one in this house touches the gas." Missy Cook was smiling, though nowhere in her face was there any bit of joy, any piece of happiness. "This is my responsibility and no one else's. Please remember this." She twisted the key, the room slowly going dark until the gas gave a small pop. She pulled the door closed behind her. She hadn't even glanced at Mama. Mama stood in the darkness a few moments and then came back to bed. "This is a dangerous place, Jewel. We have to be careful, or we'll be swallowed alive here." I knew what she meant, had seen already the power in her Mama, in her hands and eyes, in the warm food, the fine clothes. But some part of me, even after seeing whatever darkness lay in Missy Cook's brown eyes, wanted to give over to it, to nestle down into the warm bed we were in, to get up tomorrow morning and find a meal already cooked for us, put on crisp, clean dresses, and live this way. There was a soft knock at the door. A crack of light pierced the room, then filled it.
"It's just Molly, Miss Patricia, Miss Jewel. Come to get your old clothes, take care of 'em for you."
"In the corner," Mama said. We watched as Molly made her way to the end of the dresser and leaned over, took the pile of clothing up in her arms and moved back to the door.
"We see you in the morning,"
I said.
"Good night,"
Mama silent beside me. Molly pulled the door closed and here was the silence again, the dark. Then I saw the color at the window, the faint dance of orange and red across the black glass. Mama was out of the bed before me, made it to the window first, her black silhouette there against the growing color, her hands to the window. Then I stood next to her, my hands against the cool glass too. I looked down at the yard behind the house where a fire burned some 20 yards back into the rows of pecan trees. The nigger who'd unloaded Pastor's wagon for us stood next to it, a hoe in one hand, the other on his hip. Molly appeared beneath us, coming from inside the house. She was carrying something, and I knew before she was halfway to the fire that it was our clothes, the clothes she'd just gathered up in our room. She stopped at the edge of the fire, her back to us, and started into peeling off piece by piece of our clothes, tossing each garment into the fire. I turned to my Mama, saw her face flicker with the movement of the fire, the color almost lost on her.
"Why, Mama?"
"She's doing what she's been told. You watch this, because this is for you and me. You and me are supposed to be seeing this, supposed to be standing right here and watching it all. Then the nigger dropped the hoe and headed away from the fire, disappeared somewhere near the house and to our left. I glanced up at Mama. She hadn't moved, but when I turned back to the fire, I heard her swallow hard. I know what Marcus has gone for. He reappeared, this time carrying something high and over his head. Mama's cane chair. Molly edged back from the fire as he came closer. He stopped, eased the chair down from his shoulders, and laid it on the fire. For a few moments, nothing happened, the frame of the chair like some strange and twisted skeleton. But then the seat caught, and the wood of it, and the flames grew until the sparks it gave off drifted high and above the tops of the trees before giving up. "This is for us," she whispered. I didn't look at her, afraid of what I might see. The day she died, 2 months later, began with me sitting with a pencil and tablet in an overstuffed chair I'd had Marcus pull close to her bed. She'd taken ill 2 weeks before and hadn't eaten in 4 days, taken in nothing more than sips of cool water Molly gave her. I hadn't shown Mama the picture of Jacob, had kept it hidden since the day I'd gotten it, but for some reason that morning I pulled it out from where I'd wedged it, deep between pages. The room was kept dark all day, summer beginning to rise around us in thick walls of heat. My legs kicked beneath me as I studied the picture. Then I heard my mama's voice. "Your Grandpa Jacob." My legs stopped kicking. I turned to her. I thought her still asleep, but her eyes were open and she was looking at me, her eyes full and small in her face. Her hair, unbraided and fanned out on the pillow, was wet at the temples and hairline. She swallowed, closed her eyes, and opened them again. She brought a hand from her chest to her forehead and let it rest there. "You listen. You need to know what stock you're from, I'm telling you." She let her eyes close. "Your daddy's daddy was long dead before I met Joseph, but people knew about him. People knew Jacob Chandler was a horse dealer. He was. Your daddy's mama was just a cracker. Left Jacob Chautauqua with 2 boys, Benjamin and Joseph, when Joseph was only 2. And Jacob left those 2 with his sisters, Choctaws, living in shanties up near Columbus. That's how your daddy was raised. I thought he would be different from his daddy." She paused. "He wasn't. But it wasn't stealing horses he was bad about. It was me." She swallowed again and I looked at the picture, rubbed my finger across the face. "Your grandpa was caught stealing horses and they brought him into Columbus, running through court and had him up to a tree just north of town, him sitting on one of the horses he'd stolen, a rope round his neck. All this before sundown the same day. They were gonna hang him. And your daddy was there. Him and Benjamin both sitting on the shoulders of those squaws. They were there to watch their own daddy get hanged for horse stealing. They gave the horse a swat, and the thing was gone. Your grandpa hanging and swinging from the tree. The way your daddy told it, the only sound he could hear was the heavy creak of the rope. He says he watched his own daddy's feet stepping on air trying to find something firm to stand on. But there was nothing." Mama's eyes were wide open, her mouth closed. One hand was at her throat, moving slowly back and forth. Her eyes, it seemed, were focused on nothing. "And then the rope broke. It snapped up near the limb, your daddy tells me, and Jacob fell to the earth. He didn't move for a while, neither did anybody watching. But then he sat up and looked around, and he was smiling. And then they let him go, 'cause it was God's will." The sheriff just bent over him sitting there on the ground,
loosed the rope round his neck and the one round his hands. It was God's will. I was looking at the picture, and here came my mama's hand reaching for it. I let her have it, watched as she brought it close to her face. Her hand started to trembling with the effort. This here picture was taken not a week or two after that. That's why your daddy kept this with him. It's a picture of a man who's lived through death. That's what it is. But I wish he'd been killed. I do. She closed her eyes and a tear squeezed out, slipped down her cheek and into her hair. Lord, forgive me, but I do. I wonder how Joseph would have been different if he'd seen his daddy die. I think he might have been a good man if his daddy died before his eyes. But he didn't. And he kept this picture of a man who couldn't be killed, and that's how come he turned out like he did. Her hands were on her chest now, the picture face down.
Why'd you marry him then?
Love. Hate. She paused. I knew I loved him. I knew I hated my mama. Those two things are why I married him. She shot open her eyes. She was smiling, the look on her face as strange as any I'd ever seen her give, and I thought that maybe the fever had gone through her brain, ravaged her such that she'd gone mad. She reached the picture over to me without looking at me, and I took it, then scooted a little deeper into my chair, away from her. She reached the picture over to me without looking at me. But there's things about my family you need to know. Things Missy Cook won't ever tell you. The reason we got all this, the house, the niggers and all of it, is because she married a Yankee carpetbagger. A man from Pittsburgh, the man who was my daddy. And her daddy and this Yankee carpetbagger were in cahoots together, buying up land and houses and banks after the war. She closed her eyes, the smile grown even wider. There was joy in her now, pleasure found in telling me all this. But that's not the story. Plenty of old would-be spinsters like Missy Cook married northerners like my daddy. She swallowed hard. I could see tears in her eyes, her mouth only a thin line now, no color. No, what I want you to take is this. Before the war, the town of Columbus was known as Coogan's Bluff. That's Missy Cook's maiden name, Coogan. Her daddy was who the town was named for, and that's because he owned the most niggers. He owned the most niggers in that part of the state, and he wasn't even in the Confederate forces because he owned so much land and so many niggers. She stopped again, her breaths only shallow gulps. So when the Columbus, Ohio militia marched into town, they liberate the niggers, they rename the place, and they burn down every last piece of property they know belongs to the man named Coogan, Missy Cook's daddy. But they can't find the man. And do you know why? She stopped. Slowly she turned to me, and before I realized what she'd asked, she was staring at me. But she wasn't looking at me, I could see. Her eyes were on me, but passed through me, so that my mama was already gone. Why couldn't they find him? She laughed, the sound in her like dead leaves underfoot, but then she stopped laughing, tears drifting down her cheeks. I watched my daddy get slapped across the face by Missy Cook the first time he told me this story, and I watched him laugh in her face, Missy Cook standing above him. Him in his favorite chair in the parlor, her with her hand back to hit him again. But he'd only laughed. And then because she didn't know what to do with that hand held high, palm open, she came straight to me sitting on the divan and slapped my face. And my daddy only laughed harder at that. Missy Cook just left the room. She hit me right here on this cheek, right near my eye, because I'd only listened while my daddy told me why they never found my grandpa. She paused, swallowed. Missy Cook's daddy dressed as a woman and hid out in a nigger shanty. And when those Ohio militia came through to liberate all them niggers, let them know about what Mr. Lincoln had given them, the niggers still hid him, put him into a barrel and let him hide. Dressed as a woman and hiding in a barrel right there in front of all them niggers he owned. Every one of them laughing their nigger hearts out, I'm certain, and then when the militia had gone and they were all freed slaves, they just brought him out of the barrel, stayed with him the rest of their lives. Them and their children and their children's children. Molly and Marcus, all the field niggers, they're all sons and daughters, the ones that hid my grandpa when he was dressed as a woman and balled up in a barrel. And don't think they don't remember it, neither. My hands were together in my lap, beneath them the photograph of Jacob Chandler. Jacob Chautauqua. So you take those two stories now, and you decide. Two stories of people who live through their own deaths. You take them both, and you decide why I'd marry your daddy. She paused, and I hadn't the courage to look at her, simply stared at my hands in my lap, at the photograph. You choose which of the two you want to take. One who'd lived because it was the will of God, no matter how bad the life he led. Or one who saved himself, God be damned, and passed on to his daughter a shame so fierce only hate could cover it up. She gave a small laugh, the sound only thin air forced from inside her. Oh, you could do the smart thing and pass all this up. Make your own story. Maybe, God willing, going out into this world with these stories like stones in your pockets won't make a bit of difference. The Lord knows it wasn't that way for me. Mama died late that afternoon when I was downstairs in the kitchen, Cathedral and I drinking cold buttermilk Molly'd poured for us. It was Marcus who'd been there when she died, him to come into the kitchen with the news. Miss Patricia, she passed on now. Molly gave out a quick breath, Cathedral only looking from me to Marcus and back to me, her eyes never really meeting mine. That night, once Pastor was gone, my mama's body taken to the mortician's to prepare her for a proper burial, I climbed into bed with the same nightgown on I'd worn our first night here when we'd watched our old clothes burn like pine straw in the night air. The gas light above me was still on, and out of habit I sat there, smooth, cool sheets around me, and waited for Missy Cook to push open the door, give me the same practiced and dead smile she gave each night, then turn off the gas. I was alone, finally. Cathedral had seen me into my room, followed by Molly, who touched me with the gentlest hands I could remember. But now I was alone. Sitting in my bed, waiting for the woman who'd struck my mama for no good reason but that she'd been a witness to the truth of her family. So I waited no longer. I climbed out of bed, went to the door, and reached up, slowly twisted the gas key. The room grew dark around me, the furniture, the dress of the bed, the armoire full of fine new clothing, all changing into huge and ugly shapes. Drowning in the darkness I was given. Then the room was black, and I heard the faint pop of the gas shutting off. Missy Cook couldn't have me, I knew. I wouldn't let her take into me, I wouldn't give up to her. I had the photograph and the hard and sure memory of two stories my mama told. That was what would keep me alive here. That and Cathedral and Molly. These were all with me. My baby Annie toddled into the kitchen a little after Leston and the men had finished breakfast, Wilman and Burton just starting into theirs. The niggers who ate outside had already finished too and had stacked their plates beneath the steps down from the back porch, the same place they'd find them when they headed for home tonight. Annie held on tight to the scrap rag that had once been a blanket, what now she called her Nana. She had the blanket over one shoulder, her red hair tangled with sleep, a hand to one eye and rubbing it.
Wilman and Burton, the two of them shoveling in grits and biscuits with syrup and fried eggs as quick as I could turn it out, sang together. "Annie Finney, baby with a blankie." They looked at each other, laughed, and started back in with the food. Annie turned to them, and from where I stood at the stove, I could see her eyes squinch down to nothing. Then she swung out at empty air with the hand she'd had to her eye. Burton imitated her, Wilman doing the same as soon as he'd seen what his older brother'd done. They laughed even more. From where I stood, too, I could see out the kitchen window to Luston, Toxie, Garland, and J.E., the four of them standing outside with hands in the jacket pockets, shoulders up against the cold morning, each with a cigarette to his lips. Beyond them, back near the trees, were the niggers, the ten of them forming a jumbled circle. The sun still wasn't up, and I could see the bright red spark of a cigarette tip pass from nigger to nigger, each taking one small puff and then passing it to his neighbor. Then Leston raised a hand in the air, gave a quick wave, and they were all of them off, led by my husband. He was first to disappear from my view, followed by J.E. and Garland and all the niggers except Sepulcher, a tall, thin boy whose pant legs stopped a good 4 inches above his ankles. He and Toxie went off in the opposite direction, to my left, back to where one of the trucks had been parked since they'd towed it from the woods last Thursday. Annie was hitting Burton's leg with her free hand, the other still holding on to the blanket. The boys were leaning over, poking a finger in her hair, another in her ribs, another under her chin, them laughing at each twist away the baby sister made, her giving only half-hearted squeals, enjoying the attention. It's what children did together, I'd realized only after James and Billie Jean had been at each other's throat their first 5 years or so. A game. See who could poke who the most until one or the other cried, got Mama mad. But I wasn't going that way this morning, not even after the age I'd seen in Leston's shoulders earlier. Not even after knowing there'd be another whole stretch of time in my life when another child would fall party to this game of attention and tears. Annie, as always, broke first, finally gave up slapping at Burton's leg. She backed up a foot or so from the boys and sat down on the floor. Her eyes were closed, tears spouting out now, her mouth open in a loud cry. In walked Billie Jean, still in her nightshirt and socks, one hand scratching at her head, a creased and wrinkled photoplay in the other hand. She stopped in the middle of the kitchen, yawned, then opened her eyes and said just loud enough to where she knew I'd have to make a remark, "Why can't a woman get enough sleep in this place?" She put her hands on her hips, gave a look as grown up and hard as she could muster at her brothers and sister. "Mama, we didn't make her cry," Burton hollered. Wilman put in, "Mama, she did it herself." Annie still cried. But all I could see my way to doing was to stand there at the stove, cross my arms and smile. The belly aching and crying still went on, even Billie Jean looking up at me saying, "Well, why can't a woman?" They all wanted me to break, I knew. They all wanted in their own way, nothing more than what they lost when the next child had been born. Just a hug and a soft word from me. My full and undivided attention, what I knew I would never be able to give any of them again. That was the sorrowful part of being a mother. Each of your children had to move up a notch toward some end of childhood with the birth of the next child. And so I wouldn't get mad at any of them. Wouldn't holler and carry on about getting a switch or holding back the quarter for a movie and popcorn in town Saturday if they didn't straighten up. All of them. No, this morning I would only love them. Soon enough they would know what was coming. That evening, supper spread across the table in steaming bowls and plates of hot food, we gave thanks. Leston at the head of the table, me next to him. The children, starting with Anne next to me, were seated around the table by age so that James was sitting next to Leston, all of us holding hands. "Dear Lord," Leston said, "hear our prayer.
We give you thanks for the many blessings you bestow on us each and every day, and ask that you bless this food to the nourishment of our bodies. Amen. The children let go each other's hands quick as they could, but Leston still held mine. I looked up at him and saw him smiling at me. "Almost forgot," he said. He closed his eyes, still smiling, and held his empty hand out to James, who looked at me. His face was his father's, the same spray of freckles Wilman had gotten, the broad forehead and giving eyes, the same green as my husband's. I smiled at him, but it didn't change the puzzled look he'd taken on, mouth slightly open. He said, "Mama," and slowly moved to take his daddy's hand. My eyes fell to his hand as he placed it in Leston's, and I saw the calluses and cuts, evidence of the hard work he'd been doing for over a year now at the lumber mill. But even those scars were only pale imitations of the ones Leston had had for years, his big red hand now swallowing up James's. And I remembered for a moment James's soft white hands when he was a child, remembered my firstborn at my breast, suckling to keep himself alive, drawing deep my milk and the same mighty purpose each one after that had had. James had dropped out of the high school last January when the first men left for the armed services, back when Roosevelt was making the big pleas for all able-bodied men to join up, and many a job needed doing around here went begging. He was only 15, but neither Leston nor I minded much his quitting. He learned to read and write and figure quicker than any of my children so far, had enough common sense about him to pick his way through whatever this life would give him. But he and Leston hadn't spoke much to each other since then, and I knew it was because James had chosen to take on at Crampton's and not follow his father out to the woods, not bore holes into tree stumps with a hand auger and then shove in pieces of dynamite and light fuses, scatter like scared bats. A piece of me was glad for that, too. Toxie'd already lost 3 fingers on one hand and the hearing in his right ear. This the result of a fuse too short and too fast. James had chosen instead to head out each morning to the mill, to walk the 2.5 miles there and tend saw, shoving boards at one end all day long. I knew the reason they didn't speak other than to ask for the salt or comment upon the weather, though, had more to do with Leston than James. Something in Leston made him want the family with him. Wanted his sons to be there to take up what he'd grown to consider a firm income, an honest trade. Many's the night we would lie awake and dream out loud for what we wanted, and though my own desires had more to do with seeing my children grow up with their parents alive and well, and loving brothers and sisters surrounding them, just those things I never had, Leston's was always about his own company, run by him and his boys. He imagined them all in old age, marching into the woods each morning, a battalion of niggers behind them, until every stubborn stump of heart pine had been boiled down in Pascagoula. To him, James had already abandoned the family, though I knew that for James, Crampton's was only his first chance at trying out himself on the world. "Mama," James said, still looking at me, "what's this about?" At least the two of them were still holding hands, I thought, this time of prayer what we had left to unite us. I whispered, "Just let's pray." I smiled at him and gave a small shrug. Leston's head was already bowed, waiting for us all. The children were looking at me, and I reached to Annie's hand, took it in mine, her hand bigger than even this morning, her growing up with every second that went through us all. I bowed my head, knew the children would follow. Leston said, "Dear Lord, please make certain to take care of the new life in Mama. Amen." When I opened my eyes, every one of my family was watching me, all except Annie, who reached a hand to a plate for a piece of honey cornbread. Now it was over. They all knew. And we'd begin the accommodations each had to make from here on out. Annie would be the hardest hit, I knew. Her not looking at me was sign enough she didn't yet know what any of this meant.
Billie Jean was the first to speak. What will I tell all my friends at school? On her face, some kind of pure horror. Eyebrows twisted into each other, mouth fallen open. Her hair was pulled back in a tight ponytail, and she'd had on one of Luston's old shirts, the sleeves cuffed up to her elbows. She held a fork in one hand, her knife in the other, forearms resting on the table.
What am I supposed to say? Am I supposed to just say, hey, y'all, my mama's having yet another baby?
Yes, you are, Luston said. And you listen to how you're talking to us. You listen. He'd leveled his eyes at her. This would be his last words to her about the whole matter, I knew. Billie Jean closed her eyes, nodded. Yes, sir, she managed to get out. She held them closed longer than need be, just to make to us some kind of point, one lost on Luston, who looked down to his plate, forked up collards.
A baby? Annie said, looking up at me.
She'd already eaten half the slab of cornbread she'd been given, the crumbs dusting her chin and hands. Nana, like at every meal, was draped across the back of her chair, a thin and forlorn comfort, though Annie couldn't see it unless she turned all the way around in a seat.
Another baby? Burton said. A baby? A baby? There's too many of them here already.
He turned to Wilman, gave a push at his shoulder. Wilman said,
well, you're the only baby, the only burrhead picking any round here I know of.
He pushed Burton just as hard, the two of them suddenly arms and hands. Wilman, Luston said, Burton. They stopped quick as they'd started and seemed to draw down on themselves the threat of Luston's belt across their bottoms, unspoken in this household, but always present. The boys started in on dinner as though nothing happened. The moment of Luston's silent warning and the news they'd have another child to terrorize, either lost on them or of no matter. I wasn't sure how hard Burton and Wilman would fall when the next one finally came on. They were too close together, but maybe that was better for them. They had each other, and if they chose to kill each other or to be best friends, both of which they were willing to do at any moment of a day, at least they'd have their own company. No, it was Annie, my baby Annie, I was worried most about. She was still looking up at me, only nibbled at the cornbread now, more crumbs than bread into her mouth. She held the bread with both hands, then let go with one, slowly reached over her shoulder and behind her, took hold of the blanket on the back of the chair, her eyes still on me. She blinked. I leaned toward her, brought my face down close to hers. I whispered, now don't you go to worrying, Annie. You're my baby girl, you know that. I swallowed. The hurt of the possible lie I was about to tell her thickened my throat. The memory of my mama dying pushed too close to me so that I thought I might never breathe again, not after giving to her the same comfort I'd had to give each child when they found out they wouldn't be the center of my world anymore. Mama will always be here, I said. Just you don't worry about me not ever taking care of you. I reached a hand to her face, traced the perfect curve of her cheek, touched a finger to her thin eyebrow. Mama will be here to take good care of you. She smiled, slowly pushed a corner of the cornbread in her mouth, took a bite too big to handle. She let go the blanket and brought that hand to her mouth, covered it while she chewed, her eyes on me the whole time. I sat back up, a hand still to her shoulder, and saw James staring at me, a smile on his face, too. His hands were flat on the table. He hadn't touched the ham on his plate, nor the collards or cornbread. James, I said. Luston looked at me, then to James. Their eyes met for a long moment before Luston said, son. Today's a fine day, James said, and looked down at his hands. He closed his eyes, shook his head, then he looked at me again. It's a good day because you're having a baby, he paused. It's a good day because there's a new one on the way to take the place of this old one heading out. He quick looked from me to Luston, to me. Today's a fine day 'cause I signed up today. That's why it's a fine day.
Leston turned back to his food. He leaned forward, his forearm on the table, and forked up a piece of ham. He said, "You aren't old enough." Slowly, James lost the smile. "I signed up to sign up today," he said. "It's a new program the enlistment officer downtown let me in on. So when I turn 17 next month, I'll be in the armed forces." He smiled again, this time even wider. He lifted one hand a little above the table, slapped it down.
"Imagine that!"
But I'd imagined this day all too much already. His news, nothing of the surprise he'd figured on it being. Leston and I had both known a day like this would be coming. A war we'd taken our sustenance from all along now laying claim to our son like a bad debt we owed. Billie Jean sighed, let out,
"I can't wait to see you in a uniform. It'll be so glamorous."
James laughed, shook his head again. I hadn't moved. One hand on the small shoulder of my baby Ann, thankful she still had years I couldn't imagine before she'd be out of this house. And suddenly I saw all my children lined up and waiting for a meal like this one, when each in turn would give up the love and care we had for them to a future no one could count on. And for some reason I thought of Missy Cook, dead and gone for near on 20 years. Every moment she was alive filled with the bitter taste of a daughter who'd left her for a Choctaw half-breed. You could take your child's leave, and I saw with either hate or love, no matter what doom or good luck they seemed headed for. Only hate or love. There wasn't any ground between. I reached a hand across the table to James, held it out for him. Leston, still with his arm on the table, still not having looked at his son, only took in another bite of ham. James took my hand, held it tight, his smile only growing. There was no spite here, no malice aimed at his daddy. What I knew Leston believed moved his son to work at a mill instead of for him, and now made him want to join up and fight in a war we made our living from. Here was only our son, our oldest child. I said, "God will bless you." I felt my eyes begin to fill.